Welcome to Al Bernstein Unplugged Unboxing. In a 40-year Hall of Fame career, Al has chronicled some of the greatest moments in boxing history. On this podcast, you get to hear him expand on those memories and talk about the current news in the sport of boxing. You also hear Al interview some of the biggest names in the sport. Here's Al Bernstein Unplugged.
Hi, everybody. Al Bernstein here with episode number 4 of our Al Bernstein Unplugged podcast / show. And this one should be a fun one. We've got some fun things to present to you. First of all, we're going to interview Sean Porter, the fine welterweight contender and former champion who's now a broadcaster for Fox. We also have some really good questions from you that you sent in. And I have a really wacky flashback to a fight that I'm sure most of you have never heard of, but it created some crazy, crazy circumstances. And who better to talk to about crazy circumstances than my wonderful co-host, my good friend, Mr. Trip Mitchell. Trip, how are you today?
I am great, and I can't wait for the sports books to open up in Vegas again, because I bet the over on the number of episodes of this podcast. So we're about to hit the over.
We're hitting the over on it. Oh my God. I feel like my self-esteem is just going to the ceiling.
Hey, by the way, great job last week with the Bob Arum interview. That was so much was fun to listen to.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And what I liked about it was he told great stories from the past, and we've gotten great feedback on it, but also pushed us forward in terms of what they're thinking about the future.
And one of the really interesting things, he talks about the last Wilder fight, a $17 million gate. That's just people to pay to see the fight. Are we in the wrong business? Shouldn't we be boxers?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I've been asked before to get involved in promotions, and I've never done that. But I think that would be a slight conflict of interest with announcing. Although in the world of boxing, conflicts of interest don't really count, I don't think.
And your best line from the recent show was that there's no black and white in boxing, only green. I've gotten compliments from
true.
That.
That's the one color that unifies pretty much everybody.
Do you have a favorite war between promoters? Because I know Don King and Bob Arum were at each other's throats. That's a fun part.
They were the funniest, I think. They were the best because, you know, there was after the De La Hoya Trinidad fight when Don King said, "The lights are out in Arumville." Of course, they weren't. And that was when Trinidad beat De La Hoya by a narrow margin. But theirs was the most colorful of all the rivalries. And when we get back into the swing of things, we'll see some more rivalries.
Well, speaking of that, during the interview, Bob talked about getting a start on boxing during the summer. And strategically, what a great move that would be, because if boxing comes back when we don't have baseball, basketball, or hockey, or football for that matter, boxing is going to see some great numbers.
Yeah, I think it will. And there are some, you know, of course, they want to come back safely, and the sport wants to present itself in the right way. It'll likely be without fans, of course, for the first portion of it. And there are lots of fights that are intriguing that could come back.
Speaking of that, what fights that were made are you excited to see if they can happen again in the post-COVID-19?
Yeah, right. There were a number. Boxing got off to a very nice start in 2020 in any case. And then there were fights on the books that looked really good, like they were going to continue the momentum. And here are a couple that I am so anxious to see that I think it looks like will definitely be rescheduled before the calendar year ends in 2020, whether with or without fans. One is a heavyweight matchup that was going to happen in England. Daniel Dubois and Joseph Joyce, two undefeated heavyweights, just on the cusp of breaking into that upper echelon group that includes Wilder and Fury and Joshua and Dillian White and those people. And that fight I thought was fascinating. Joyce is the older of the two. Both had really good amateur backgrounds. They're both undefeated as pros. Both more of the great heavyweights that get produced by the UK. Seems like they, you know, they're like a factory for great heavyweights in that part of the world. And these two men were going to create, I think, a terrific fight. I'm pretty sure that fight's going to be back on track. I can't wait to see that one. Another fight, Jose Ramirez, the 140-pound champion, who is an all-action fighter, very exciting, also a vulnerable fighter. You know, his style lends itself to him getting hit and him hitting other people. He was going to take on Victor Postol. Now, Victor Postol is a veteran, and some people may think that his best days were behind him, but he proved otherwise in a fight that I announced a little while ago when he took on Josh Taylor, who is now considered, along with Ramirez, perhaps the top 140-pounder in the world. And Postol gave him everything he wanted in that ring, everything he could handle. I did that fight in Glasgow, Scotland, and the scoring was far too wide in the victory for Josh Taylor, even Barry McGuigan, who was at that point Josh Taylor's promoter and manager, even he admitted that the scoring was too wide. So it was a very close and good fight. And what I love about that fight is stylistically it's a great matchup. Jose Ramirez, a come-forward, aggressive fighter. Postol, taller, more length, more reach, who boxes well, but has a little pop in his punch. And so I think that is going to be a great match. And then there was one that wasn't officially announced, but now is. And that is the fight that it appears to going to take place between Gervonta Davis and Leo Santa Cruz. With Santa Cruz coming up in weight, he had gone up to 130 pounds. Of course, he was a multiple champion in several weight divisions below that. And now he wants to take on Gervonta Davis, the lightweight champion. Now, where that fight will be fought, what weight class that will be fought at, is a question. Can Davis get down to 130? I doubt it. Santa Cruz has only fought one time at 130 moving up, so he'd have to move up yet another way to 135 if they fought at lightweight. And even making lightweight for Gervonta Davis has been a bit of a struggle. So that's the big question there. Stylistically, it's a terrific matchup. Santa Cruz, again, tall with a great reach, a volume puncher. And Gervonta Davis, a power puncher who's pretty quick with his hands and punches with tremendous power. Has some stamina issues from time to time, and that is where Santa Cruz would like to get him into those later rounds where he feels maybe he could win a decision or even perhaps make something more dramatic happen against Davis. The big issue will be whether Leo Santa Cruz can move up that much in weight and handle the power of Gervonta Davis. That fight will be on Showtime pay-per-view, so I'll be thrilled to do it. They've said, the Mayweather Promotions, Leonard Overy said that they believe that fight's going to happen in 2020. So we'll see if that one takes place. But there are a lot of good fights, clearly, that are on the horizon. We also, on this show, don't just look ahead. We look back because we like to do a feature on this show called The Flashback. For today's flashback, we're going to look back at a fight that is on this feature, not because the fight itself was so great, but because of the circumstances surrounding it. In our interview last week with Bob Arum, we talked about all the wacky things that happened on the Top Rank Boxing series on ESPN that lasted over 15 years. And this one is way high at the top of the list when it comes to wacky things happening. It was a fight on April 11th, 1983, featuring Sean Mannion and Danny Chapman. It was in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and Sean Mannion was getting ready to fight for a world title against Mike McCallum. And all he had to do was win this fight, a keep busy fight, against veteran Danny Chapman. Mannion was the big favorite. This was his home area of Massachusetts. He had emigrated from Ireland, but these were his fans, and Cape Cod was his area where he was fighting. And all he had to do was beat Danny Chapman. Well, for the first six or seven rounds in the fight, everything was going along swimmingly. Sean Mannion, a stylish lefty boxer, was doing extremely well and winning the fight. Now we hit round eight, and all of a sudden Danny Chapman, who was a decent fighter, started making some inroads, and he was battering Sean Mannion. Now we flash forward to round number 10, the final round of the fight. Danny Chapman lands a couple of body punches that are so devastating, Mannion would later find out he had a cracked rib as a result of it, And Sean Mannion was in desperate trouble. He was grasping at Chapman, looked like he was gasping for air, and it looked really like his dream of fighting for a world championship was about to go down the tubes. And then something kind of mysterious, and from Sean Mannion's standpoint, miraculous happened. The lights went out in the arena. Go figure. Well, they were out for about 20 minutes. Then miraculously, the lights returned. And at that point, and miraculously, it returned there was about a minute and a half left in the round, the 10th round. They got them back after this 20-minute delay, and Sean Mannion, with some time to recover, kind of struggled his way through the last minute and a half of the fight, and justifiably, if from the standpoint of the actual scoring, was given a decision and won the fight. Now, needless to say, there was a lot of speculation that this was kind of odd, that there was a blackout. And that speculation grew even more intense when it was revealed the next day that there was no blackout anywhere in the Cape Cod area that night, except for that specific arena. So most folks to this day believe, and there's been much speculation, that perhaps somebody found a way to pull the plug on the lights. Now, the other thing that happened was when the lights came back up, this crowd had been drinking heavily, and no great shock. Every time I went to Massachusetts, something happened in with the crowds. They were pretty fired up. And when the lights came back up, when you look, it was mid-scuffle all around the arena. There were like at least four or five different fights going on between people. They finally got all that quelled, and it was a pretty crazy night. So after we sign off on the air, the weirdness did not end, because I went to the bathroom in the arena getting ready to leave. And I go into this, it was not a big bathroom, it wasn't a giant arena, but there are about five urinals there, and a gentleman walks, and nobody's in any of the other urinals. A gentleman walks in, and he's dressed in all black leather, and he's got all kinds of chains, and he's, you know, and he comes in and stands right next to me, at the urinal next to me, even though there's four more that he could have stood at if he liked. He reaches into the back of his thing, and pulls out a big handgun and puts it on the urinal and looks at me and said, "What did you think of the fight?" To which I replied, "What would you like me to think about the fight?" He just kind of chuckled and he said, "Yeah, it's quite a night, wasn't it?" Now, I'm desperate to hopefully have been done with my business at that point so I could get out of there, but alas, I wasn't. He somehow finished before me, took the gun, put it back in the back of his pants, and as he's walking out, he turns to me, he said, "Now, you be careful tonight, because there's some weird people out there. You could bump into some of those really crazy people out there." And he was a little late with that advice, was he not? It was never determined 100% that the lights were turned off, but just about everybody who's reasonable thinks that it was, and there have been a number of efforts at investigative journalism to figure it out. So that was our night in Cape Cod back in Massachusetts many, many years ago. Nothing that wacky has ever happened, to the best of my knowledge, with a Sean Porter fight. He's had some great fights and maybe some unexpected activity in the ring, but this young man, who is 30-3, was a former IBF champion who has fought the very best in his weight class and is now a broadcaster with Fox, also happens to be one of the most engaging people in the sport of boxing, and we had a chance to interview him, and here's that interview. Sean, how are you? It's good to get a chance to visit with you. Yeah. And even in our sheltering at home status, it's great to get a chance to see you.
Keeping it together. Family's still alive. I haven't killed anyone yet. So.
This is a good thing.
my son's two, so the terrible twos, I just found out that that's a real thing.
Oh.
And my wife actually just left to the doctor. So we have another baby coming in July. So
congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We're almost there. That is great. Yeah. Yeah, you are quite the family man. And this, you know, it's funny. We had Andre Ward on a few shows ago, and you know, he has three older kids that are of varying ages.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the fact that it's with all the you're not at that point necessarily yet, but with all the homeschooling that people are required to do now.
Yeah.
He said it is, you know, he said it's a constant thing. And Brian Custer, who also has several kids, you know Brian very well, of course, same thing, you know, it's a lot.
Yeah, and I know for me, I just ordered the ABCs, and I ordered the 1-2-3s, flashcards and things like that. And that even is still kind of hard for me to get him into doing, because obviously him being two, the attention span is but that long.
Yes.
But the one thing I found myself thinking is I wish my son was about 7 or 8 years old, because then we could just play Monopoly all day after the schoolwork, you know, so.
You can have a little more fun playing other games.
Yeah, for the most part, we're all managing. My dad actually lives about, when I jump on my bike to go to his house, it takes me about 20 seconds to get to his house.
Cool.
And I don't even pedal. So he's in the same gated community as me. And he's got a bag up now, and he's got a couple of other different exercise machines and things like that. I think I sent you one video of me hitting the bag.
Yeah, you did. That was great. Yeah.
We have just gotten back into the swing of training and all of that kind of stuff. So I think now we're gearing towards being ready whenever boxing's back.
Which is a key point. I was going to ask you about that, but you led right into it. It's important at this juncture to stay ready, because once they decide that matches are going to happen, you might not have the full 8-week training camp.
Here's the cool part about it. I'm 33. I've been training as a boxer since I was about 5 or 6 years old. I'm 32 going on 33. And the majority of my training between the age of 8 to about 16 and 17, most of that was done at home. A lot of that was done right there in the backyard or on the street. So I really have kind of tried to adopt this young mentality of I'm back to the old school, you know? So I got a feeling that whoever we get in the ring with, they're going to be in trouble, because not too many guys are used to training the way that I grew up training, you know? So we are utilizing the backyard now, and then eventually we'll be utilizing the street out front doing sprints and things like that. And then also we have a high school, Liberty High School.
Yeah.
Their track is open. So I'm getting on the track now twice a week as well.
That's a really interesting point you just made. Not all boxers, the beginning part of when boxing comes back will tell us a lot about how fighters prepared, how they stayed ready. And not everyone, as you point out, is kind of low tech enough to know, hey, I might not have all the bells and whistles, but this will work for me.
The great way to put it is low tech. And I think, you know, I did a Facebook Live about a week ago, and I walked down the street. Badu lives in the same complex as us as well.
Oh, Badu Jack,
And Badu Jack has built out his garage. He's got some bags up and treadmills and things of that nature. And I just wanted to relay to the fighters out there on my live that you have to be able to utilize anything that's around you right now. Whether it's your street, whether it's a tree in the backyard that you can tie a pillow around it and use it as a bag. Right now, we're being separated. You're about to find out who is really committed to their craft, and who's a professional at what they do, and who's not, and who is just using this time as time to kind of just lay around and relax, you know. Granted, this is a time for us to be with our family. I'm with my son all day, every day. I'm with my wife all day, every day. But at the same time, I've made it possible for myself to separate from them so that I can remain a professional at what I do. And I think that right now, that's what we all need to do. We need to figure out different ways to stay professional. I mean, you're in your own home, but you got your tech guys on here, which is awesome, you know? So we all have to remain professional. And I think right now there's about to be a humongous separation between even the world champions who are professional world champions and the world champions who are not professional world champions and not responsible for their lives and their daily activity and their career.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You're echoing, as I mentioned, Andre Ward talked about that with us, and you're echoing a lot of what Andre had to say.
Who do I learn from?
Yeah, no, you both, as both, as both, you know, you both share in common the fact that you are known as people that have always been prepared and always ready to ply your craft, and so it's not surprising you two would have similar viewpoints. Now, you, while you haven't been fighting, you did make a little news this past week because in an interview, you suggested, you must have been asked the question, or I don't know if you volunteered or you were asked, somebody must have asked you about if Terrence Crawford fought Errol Spence, and you suggested, if they quoted you correctly, you suggested that you thought at this juncture Terrence Crawford might beat Errol Spence in a fight.
And I don't have a problem speaking about that. I'll speak about it publicly anywhere I go. So, and you've seen me on Fox now. I work as an analyst. But even before doing work for Fox as an analyst, I've always been a very analytical person.
Everything
that I do is very analytical and, you know, and calculated, you know. So when I voice my opinion on who would win that fight, it doesn't come from me being biased towards Terrence Crawford because I lost in the fight.
Sure, understandable.
When I take a look at the styles, when I take a look at who can do what, the different components that both guys have, the experience that both guys have, knowing Errol Spence from being in the ring with him, but knowing Terrence Crawford for as long as I've known Terrence and seeing him on so many different platforms, different national tournaments winning, and now even as a professional winning time and time again, when I do the math for myself, I think that that's a fight that Terrence Crawford would win. I think that he wins the fight from the outside, and I think that he could manage a fight from the inside when he needs to, but I think that for the most part he'd win the fight from the outside. He has abilities from he has abilities from the southpaw position as well as the orthodox position. Yeah. Great boxer, speed, the mechanics, the intuition in the ring, and all of that. I just think that's a fight that Terrence Crawford would win.
Well, you're in an interesting position to comment on that. Of course, you did fight Errol Spence, and it was a terrific fight, razor thin fight. And you used many of the boxing skills you're talking about.
Yeah.
In the course of that fight with Errol Spence, you fought a thinking man's fight.
Yeah.
Of course, used your physicality as well when you needed to, but you were able to employ many things in that fight that kind of put Errol Spence a little bit on his heels. It was a great fight, and
I love telling this story. I have a mentor of mine out in New York is actually my tailor who does my suits. We always talk after the fights, and he has this question that he likes to ask me. He said, he'll say, you know, you had him, didn't you? I said, oh yeah, I knew I had him. And he says, we had this conversation about the fight with Errol. He says, he looked at me, said, do you know you had him? I said, oh yeah. He said, when did you know you had him? I said, I'll be honest, Malcolm. It was about the fifth or sixth round. I did a pullback counter on his jab. So he threw a jab. I pulled back just slightly and I countered him with a jab. And he shook his head and he cursed. And I could tell that he knew he shouldn't have gotten hit with what I hit him with. And it let me know that I was thinking ahead of him. And he recognized that I was ahead of him at that point in the fight. And so, you know, it's always, you know, the experiences that I've had in the ring are what carry me on to the next fight. And so, one thing that I know about me, they say styles make fights. And when I'm a rare commodity because I have a number of different styles that I can use in the ring. And I think when you say, okay, who wins? Errol Spence or Sean Porter? Who wins? Terrence Crawford or Sean Porter? Who wins? Manny Pacquiao or Sean Porter? Who wins? Danny Garcia or Sean Porter? With me, you really don't know because styles make fights. And I can bring so many different elements to the game that not many people can do. But I do think that when you take a look at the style that Errol Spence has and the style that Terrence Crawford has, I think Terrence Crawford has a little bit more than Errol Spence. And I think Terrence Crawford will win the fight.
Yeah. You rightfully pointed out that you are a chameleon in the ring because you are able to do different things. And one of the interesting things about your career, of course, is that you have fought literally just about everybody, with the exception of maybe Terrence Crawford, just about everybody who is an elite welterweight, not Manny Pacquiao either, but you know, you fought Spence, you fought Ugas, very tough man, Danny Garcia, Keith Thurman, Kell Brook before that. Do you think sometimes it gets kind of glossed over, the idea that you have probably fought the overall the toughest schedule of maybe anybody in the welterweight division?
You know what, one thing could be is that I think maybe if you start from all the way from the beginning of when I became world champion, that was Devin Alexander, and then you just kind of
right.
you take a look at the fights from
sure.
from Devin Alexander on, I think I've gotten better in every fight, and I think that there's been something different in every fight, and I think it kind of wipes away what happened in the previous fight. And one thing my dad has always taught me, he says boxing does not care about you. Boxing only cares about what have you done for me lately.
Right.
And I think because the next fight is better than the previous fight, I think that some of the greatness has kind of been lost in the shuffle of other greatness. But you know, for me, it's all a matter of, again, what have you done for me lately? You know, so we can talk about the fight that I had with Errol Spence, and we can go down a list of all of the different fights. But if I don't win the very next fight, then that tarnishes everything that's happened before, you know? So it's not the opposite, you know? So when you win, it's like, you know, that was great. What's he going to do next? Right. It's not, you know, you're not going to say that was great, but look at what he did against such and such, you know? So that's just how it goes, but that's the game. And,
true.
And I don't mind. I think a lot of times people do forget about my quote unquote resume and who I've been in the ring with. But my whole thing there is, hey, just get on the internet and take a look, and you'll be reminded
quickly
of who Showtime Sean Porter is.
Yeah, the facts are there, that's for sure. Yeah. And you mentioned you're almost 30, you're going to be 33, you're 32 years of age. And you're one of those fighters who has always stayed in fantastic condition. You've not taken a huge amount of punishment in the ring.
Yeah.
When you look at yourself as a person about to be 33, what do you see, Dom, in terms of the number of years you would still like to fight?
You know, I'll be honest with you. I'm extremely blessed. You talk about the names that I've been in the ring with, and you know, not much punishment. And I'm very, very healthy. You know, and I'm very, very grateful for that, especially given who I've been in the ring with. Speaking to my wife just last night, we were talking about the plan when I turned pro. The plan between the team was my dad, myself, and maybe a couple of other just advisors that we were dealing with at that point in time. And my dad said, I want you to be done by the time you're 30. He says, by the time you're 30, you should have done enough that you can be done. I think way back at then, neither of us really knew what it would take to get to the point that we're at now.
That's right.
But getting to the point that I'm at now, it's telling my wife, you know, I'm extremely blessed to be as healthy as I am fighting now, 32 going into 33, which wasn't the plan. I said, but God has continued to lead me to fight, so I'm going to continue to fight. And I said, and with this COVID virus going on, that set everybody back a year. So,
yeah,
you know, hypothetically, even if I was going to be 30 this year, it set me back a year. So I still would fight until I'm 31. So right now, I still feel like the sky's the limit for me. I still feel like there's some great fights to be had out there for me. And I feel great. So, and the best part about it is with this COVID virus going on, I think it's become a gut check for all of us.
Yeah.
Gut check for no matter what you do and who you are, it's become a gut check for you. And it's really forced us all to get some things right in our lives.
Good point.
So I think for me, the thing to get right is being 32 going into 33. It's not about how hard you fight. It's about how smart you fight. It's about how smart you prepare for the battle that you're about to go into. So, you know, call me crazy, but I'm grateful for this time that I have now to kind of rejuvenate myself and get some things running the correct way before we get back in the ring.
It's really interesting and all very good points. You are a proud Buckeye, born in Ohio, and a proud Cleveland Browns fan. But now you live in Las Vegas and you've been out here for a number of years, and you and I cross paths out here sometimes at places where music's going on, and we
oh, you sing, man. I was blown away. I'm blown away right now just talking about it. I was blown away. I had no
clue. Came out to see me sing a couple times.
Yeah
we had fun, you and your dad. And you have taken, it seems to me, and you can enlighten me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that you have taken to Las Vegas, and you, like many of us who move here, and I've been here longer, you are starting to get a sense of, look, we got a visitor. How are you? You've started to get a sense of home here, haven't you?
Absolutely. Being here now 7 years, this is definitely home. And I'm great that you bring that up because I have a couple of friends here. I got about 8 good friends here, 3 of which are from back home in Cleveland. So
yeah.
So my circle is very small. And I have 2 friends that are born and raised here, or basically born and raised here. And we're going to go out this weekend to Summerlin Hospital, I believe. And we're going to give out dinners and lunches to the nurses and the doctors up there. Just our way of giving back. And eventually we want to grow that. I think my basis will be Vegas and Cleveland in terms of where my direct help is. And then from there, I want to expand. But the Porter Way is the Porter Way Foundation is what we're going to start ramping up here. And we're going to start helping out these hospitals the best
for you. Can.
And so when you talk about being home, I really want to take care of these hospitals here and show them that the people care about what's going on and how they're helping. And I think right now that's the best way I can do it.
Well, you have been so well received in this city, and people here like to think of you as an adopted son. You know, you've come here and you've been a part of the community. And I know from talking to, you know, lots of people here in Las Vegas that they appreciate the fact that you're not just here, you're a part of the community.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I am very much so a part of the community, but again, that's who I am. I think when you first came on, you said, you know me to be a very big family, man. I very much so am. And, along with my family, I mean, I think, you know, I try to give my family the best. And so I have to take care of my community and those in my community so that we do have the best that we can have.
Yeah. Is he having fun? Is he enjoying has he been enjoying this little time with you being around so much?
The best part about this is he does not know what's going on. That's the best part about it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've told people if you're upset about what's going on, if you're worried because you're not working, you're worried, you know, about this and that, get around a kid. Get around a child, because children have no recollection of what's going on right now, and they just want to laugh and smile and have fun.
True.
And they really will put a smile on your face. So he's been able to do that more than anything. It's just really, you know, we dealing with the news and all that kind of stuff, and he's got close ears to it, and all he knows is Toy Story and have fun. So
exactly.
He definitely gets me away from everything that's going on.
Sean, we had a situation where my wife and I, our house burnt, and we had to almost burnt down. We had to live. Before we could get a rental house, we were living with my mother-in-law for about 2 weeks. And my son was a little older than him. And we must have watched the first Toy Story, I'm going to say 50 times in about a 3-week period. Yeah. I can recite every single line from that story. So I get where you're coming from.
He's 2.5, and he can do word for word. He even loves the opening. You know, Disney has the opening
yes.
show, the castle and all that. He will hum the music to that, and he really is just a joy to be around and extremely.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now you alluded to the fact that you've been broadcasting now on Fox and doing an excellent job.
Thank you.
And that kind of lends itself to your approach, because you should point out you try to approach boxing from not always an emotional standpoint, though that's part of it, but also the analytical part. Have you enjoyed the broadcasting that you've been doing?
I love it. I can't wait to get back to it. I think right now my focus more so is fighting. But we do have a text with the Fox group going on, and they're trying to figure out how to keep us working. So I love it. I love being able to really break things down. I think that I have a mind that's different from most opinions out there. And I think that I give people a view that they don't really recognize it's not their first instinct to see.
Yeah.
So I think with that being said, I think that's why I love it so much, because I know that it's almost like an advantage. Because I know that I'm going to be able to say something that you either didn't recognize, or if you recognize it, you didn't really understand it. And so I love that part of what I'm doing so far. And I can't wait to get back doing it. I can't wait to get back to Fox Studios.
Well, you're doing a great job, and you're doing a great job as a family man, as we can see here. Yeah. And I wish you guys the best during this time. And you've always been a great fighter for me to cover, and yeah. I've had the privilege of doing a number of your fights, and it's always been a joy to deal with you, Sean.
You got it. I told my dad earlier we were training. I told him that I would be on the line with you today. He told me to tell you hello.
Yeah, for sure. Well, tell him I said hi.
Yeah, go ahead. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, we got two for the price of one in this interview.
Oh, that's yeah. It's good. Important right there. Yeah.
So that was an extra bonus for us. I wish you guys the best during this period. And before I let you go, let me just ask you, when you come back, what would be your guess as to when you think you might do it? And do you have any opponents lined up that you've been thinking about?
You know what? I have no clue right now. This is what I do know. I know that myself, I'm not a fighter that needs a tune-up. I'm not a fighter that's...
No, you never get tune-ups.
Yeah, I'm not a fighter that really needs to get in there and kind of feel the fight out and get comfortable. I'm ready to go when they call my name. As far as I know, it will be this year that boxing wants to come back. I'm hoping that it's this year, and I'm hoping to be, you know, right there in that top tier of those guys that get back in the ring. I heard something that Garcia mentioned that he would want to fight me. I was surprised to hear that, but if that's something that that Garcia team wants to do, we can make that fight happen. I think that would be a great fight. And I think
done it before with him, and it was a terrific fight.
The other Garcia.
Oh, Mikey Garcia. Yeah, Mikey Garcia.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, Mikey, excuse me. Yeah, I didn't want to say Danny's name, and I always end up mixing them.
Yeah, no, my bad. I should have known it was Mikey.
Yeah,
that would be an intriguing fight for sure.
And what I was going to say is we know that when we come back, there's not going to be any crowd. There's not going to be a walk-up, a tailgate pricing or anything like that. No tickets sold, so I think the best thing for them to do is to try to find out who's the best fights to put on pay-per-view and who's willing to get in the ring. So if Mikey wants to do it, then let's so be it. If not him, then we'll figure it out. But yeah, see me before the end of the year.
Trick is to get everybody back in health and get the sport running again. Sean, thank you so much for taking the time.
You got it, my man.
All right, take care. Bye, buddy.
Tell him Showtime. Say Showtime.
Take care.
Showtime. See you later.
So you can see why I referred to Sean Porter as one of the most engaging people in boxing. He is that, but also has lots of substance. Interesting things to say about what's going on in the world of boxing, and it was fun to revisit some of his boxing moments as well. Now, every week we get questions from you that you send in to Twitter. They are always interesting, always unique. And Mr. Trip Mitchell, we've got some good ones and interesting ones this week, don't we?
We do, and throughout history, boxers are multi-talented. Roy Jones was a basketball player and a boxer.
True.
But this question more on the entertainment front, and it kind of hits home to the fact that you're an accomplished singer, and it's which boxer sings the best? And if you had to record a duet, which one would you choose?
Very intriguing question, but an easy one to answer. There have been boxers. Joe Frazier had a musical group. Larry Holmes did. Oscar De La Hoya did an album. Manny Pacquiao has recorded some music. And there have probably been some others as well. But it's an easy question to answer because by far the most talented boxer to be a professional musician was the late Ernie Terrell, who was a heavyweight champion briefly in the 1960s. He was a top contender who fought and beat most everybody in that era, except for Muhammad Ali, who he lost to. And Ernie was a champion in 64 and 65, had a piece of the heavyweight championship. But he was also a very accomplished musician. He was a good guitar player and singer and songwriter. And he called his group Ernie Terrell and the Heavyweights. Not shocking, right? His sister, Jean Terrell, was in the group. Now, Jean Terrell was very, very talented, and she would go on to replace Diana Ross as a member of the Supremes when Diana Ross left that group. And to give you an idea of the talent of Ernie and his group, here's a clip of Ernie performing on the Hollywood Palace back in the 60s. And this show aired only two nights before Ernie Terrell was to fight Muhammad Ali. Take a listen.
With the hammer and a nail.
With the hammer and a nail.
With the axe and a saw.
With an axe and a saw.
With the pencil and a ruler.
With the pencil and a ruler.
And my old grandma.
And my old grandma, yeah.
Grandpa built a house so
strong.
A place where they call home. It's where my mom.
With the hammer and a nail.
With the rocks and the sand.
With the rocks and the sand.
With the picture from a book.
With the picture from a book.
And his own bare hands.
And his own bare hands, yeah.
Grandpa built a house so strong. A place where they call home. It's where my mama and my daddy told me I was born. It's where my mama and my daddy told me I was born. It's where my mama and my daddy told me I was born.
So that was evidence of what I was talking about. Ernie wrote that song, by the way, as well, and he and his sister and their group did a fine job with it. Now, Trick, you may be surprised to know that when I realized we had this question, I actually gave some thought to the actual song I would duet with to Ernie Terrell. So are you proud of me for doing my homework on this one?
This is very impressive, Al.
All right, I know. My goal is to make you proud, so that's all I'm here for. I came up with a song that I had heard Ernie sing, and it involves our hometown. Ernie's from Chicago, and of course I'm from Chicago, and there's a famous blues song called Going to Chicago, and I do it in my act all the time. And just to give people an idea, here's a little taste of that. right. So if you come and hear me sing, you're likely to hear me do Going to Chicago. Unfortunately, Ernie Terrell passed away in 2014. So alas, we will not be duetting to that. Ernie was a wonderful, wonderful man and greatly missed in boxing. But so there's the answer to the question of most talented boxer to be in music and the man I would most likely duet with.
And it's funny, Al, having seen you sing, you ended up marrying a singer. So your son is not a boxer. He is a...
No shock. He is a singer-songwriter. We certainly didn't expect him to become a doctor or an insurance salesman, both of us being in entertainment. And the music was a likely possibility for him.
That's fantastic. Our next question is, you've interviewed fighters and during which you've had a unique way of asking tough questions without being a wise guy or without belittling fighters, which is an art. The question is, did you have a mentor? How did you develop your style of broadcasting?
Yeah, I don't know if I had a mentor of a person that I looked at, though there are some very fine people in boxing and other sports who have been great interviewers. But it kind of, I was thrown into the breach with the Top Rank Boxing Show because we did, 40-some shows a year, and I had to interview at least two or three fighters every week after they had boxed. And there's two kind of interviews you do with fighters. One is right after a fight, and then the other is in obviously when you have more time, whether it's in a studio setting or you've gone to interview them at the gym or some other place. Interviewing them in the ring is an intriguing situation because you only normally have maybe three, maybe four questions max that you can ask. So you have to have a roadmap. And one of the most important things to me is you never ask the toughest question first. You never ask the one that could be the most difficult for them to answer or might be even a little controversial. You never ask that first. You always ask a question that will make them feel, you know, good about the interview and have some rapport. And a good thing to remember also is you're interviewing someone who's just gone through a fight where they've been hit in the head a bunch of times and they've been through a rigorous physical activity. And so I think it's important to make them feel comfortable. The other thing that's important in an interview situation like that is don't ask big, long, convoluted, tricky questions where you're showing how smart you are by explaining a bunch of things, because you just want to get to the nuts and bolts of what you're asking. And the other thing that I, as an interviewer, that is my guidepost is I'm there to get information for the viewer. I am not there to show knowledge I have. I'm not there to show the world that I can ask a tough question. And so maybe part of that is what the questioner was alluding to, that my style of interviewing is one that is wrapped in what I think is a respectful way to approach athletes, but hopefully can still get at information, even information that might be tough for them to acknowledge. And I would suggest that approach gets you more likely to get them to talk about things that are a little tougher for them. So that's my approach to that.
And Al, having done it quite a bit myself,
yes,
the challenge is you're standing next to a guy who's sweating and bloody.
Right.
I bet your dry cleaning bill is through the roof.
Exactly. And by the way, I should say Tripp is an excellent interviewer, both for sports he's done on site and also in other locations. So you are, and you employ many of the same techniques that I just suggested.
So how about the bloodiest fighter you've ever been with?
Oh, God, when you're standing next to them and there's blood all over the place. Wow. Well, I did an interview with Vito Anafirmo once after a fight. Enough said, right? I mean, Vito bled during the pre-fight instructions. So that speaks for itself.
That does. And then finally, this is another kind of inside boxing broadcasting, which people, I'm getting great response on these questions because they want to learn about things. And is there anyone from a different network who you'd love to have called a fight with? And also, do you prefer calling fights with a two-man team or a three-man team?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. Now, as far as somebody that I didn't get to, I've announced with so many people, but there are some that I have never announced with. But there's one gentleman who I did a couple of fights with on pay-per-views, but didn't really get to work with him regularly. And I consider him one of the very best that's ever done it. And that is Tim Ryan. he and Gil Clancy did the fights on CBS, and during the first decade or so of my broadcasting career in the 80s and even into the early 90s, Tim was doing boxing on CBS and some other places as well. And he did it almost exclusively with the great Gil Clancy, who was kind of a mentor to me as a broadcaster and was a close friend. And he and Tim, it was like watching, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, you know, they were just so beautifully choreographed. And I did get to sit in on a couple of broadcasts where I sat in with both of them. And so I did get to do a few hot fights where I was with Tim, but I would have loved the chance to work with him more often. Now, as it relates to the 2- and 3-man booth, the genesis of how boxing has gone is the same way it's gone for every single sport. Every sport started out with a 1-man booth way back in the day when it was radio and maybe just beginning TV, moved to a 2-man booth. And then in most cases these days, or many cases, moved to a 3-man booth. Back in the day when I was doing the Olympic Festival for ESPN, and Barry Tompkins, who was my normal partner, was hosting the Olympic Festival. So I had to do the boxing on my own. So it was 3 rounds fights, and I did it alone. And Don Dunphy, who was a mentor and a friend of mine, watched those fights, and he called me on the phone. He said, "See, I told you," because he did the fights as one person, and he felt that was the way boxing should be done, with one voice. And he said, "See, I told you, you should be doing those fights alone." I didn't have the heart to tell Don, yeah, this was like a 3-round fight, and you do maybe 2 in the evening, or 2 or 3 in the Olympic Festival. It's not like doing a 2.5-hour show alone, you know, that's a little bit more difficult. 2-man booths, in my humble opinion, are the most appropriate booth for all of sports. That's just the way I feel. I feel like 2 voices is sufficient. And for the first 30 years of my career, I was, for the most part, in 2-man booths. Then, as it was the case with most sporting situations, I ended up in 3-man booths, first with Gus Johnson and Antonio Tarver, and then when Paulie Malignaggi came on with he and Mauro, and sometimes other people are replacing them as Mauro as play-by-play man. A 3-man booth is harder to make it work. I'm not against 3-man booths. I've enjoyed the 3-man booths I've been in. I very much enjoyed working with Antonio and Gus, and I certainly enjoy Mauro and Paulie. And we talk all the time about how making that 3-man scenario work within the confines without it inundating the broadcast and still being able to give information. So it's a little trickier with the 3-man booth, but it is what sports broadcasting now is about. So that's the way you have to make it work.
Well, appreciate it. And when you and I work together, you've taught me a lot about how to be a blow-by-blow guy on TV, in that you don't have to talk about everything. The fans can see it. Let the color guy, in your case, blossom.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I'm a big believer in certain, for people that do play-by-play in boxing, I think there's a way of doing it that I think accommodates both those things. I want to mention something before we say goodbye, and that is, I talked about our Showtime broadcasts, of course. Showtime, like so many of the other networks that have sports archives, are showing, every Friday night, are showing matches to the fans out there to give them something to look at. And on Friday, May 8th, which is the day this podcast drops, you can watch that evening. You can watch Keith Thurman taking on Sean Porter, and also his fight with Danny Garcia. That'll be on Showtime. And then the following Friday, you can look at Floyd Mayweather taking on Marcos Maidana in their first fight, which I thought was a very exciting fight. A fight that, by the way, I thought was a draw, even though Mayweather got a close decision win. And also the fight that created such a hoopla in the boxing and MMA world, Floyd Mayweather against Conor McGregor. So those two are on May 15th, and you can take a look at those. And May 8th, it's Thurman against Porter and Thurman against Garcia. Tripp, always a pleasure to get together for these podcasts.
I enjoy it and can't wait for next week.
Yeah, we're going to have fun. Our next show, we will have Kevin Ioli as our special guest. So we hope you will join us, and we'll see you next time.